This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Marc Maron, has a new stand-up comedy special on Netflix called End Times Fun.
I don't know what's happening, people. I don't know. But it's pretty clear the world is ending. I don't want to shock anybody. Seems to be happening, though.
Maron recorded this special and gave it the title End Times Fun before the coronavirus. It was listed in the Daily Beast as one of the 10 best stand-up specials to stream under coronavirus quarantine. In a review of End Times Fun in the New York Times, Jason Zinnemann wrote, "Maron is the rare comedian to ask the really big questions, the existential ones that take on more urgency in a crisis." Maron has been doing comedy for a long time, but now he's an actor, too. He starred in his own series, Maron, playing a character like himself. He co-stars in the series Glow, and in Joker, he played the producer of the late-night TV show hosted by Robert De Niro's character. And of course, he hosts his popular interview podcast, WTF. Before we talk, let's get back to the clip that we just heard from End Times Fun. Here it is in context.
I don't know what's happening, people. I don't know. But it's pretty clear the world is ending. I don't want to shock anybody. Seems to be happening, though. I thought we'd get out. You know, I thought we'd make it under the wire. I thought I would, you know. I'm 56, but I don't know. I think we might see it. I think we might see it. Certainly, it's been ending environmentally for a long time, and we've all kind of known it. We knew it. But I think on a deeper level, the reason we're not more upset about the world ending environmentally is I think, you know, all of us in our hearts really know that we did everything we could. You know, we really, right? I mean, we really did. I mean, think about it. We brought our own bags to the supermarket. Yeah, that's about it. Like, we brought the bags right when they told us. We brought them, and it just wasn't enough, it turns out. Just not enough to, you know, get us over the top with this.
I recorded this interview with Marc Maron just a few hours before California Governor Gavin Newsom ordered Californians to stay at home. Marc Maron lives in L.A. Marc Maron, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for doing this. How are you?
I'm okay, Terry. It's great to talk. Great to hear your voice. I'm all right. Thank you. I'm okay. You know, I'm trying to stay inside. I'm trying to isolate and quarantine and not be exposed or expose anybody. Who knows who has it and who doesn't?
Is the virus bringing to the surface anxieties that you already had, but that you'd kind of quieted down recently?
Not till this morning. For some reason, this morning was not great. But for the most part, it's an odd thing about being a recovering hypochondriac, which I am, which I really had wrestled with that all of my life. But when it does hit me, it hits me pretty hard, but it doesn't hit me too often. I, for the most part, have been relatively calm about this in the sense that I had framed it in my head that, you know, we had to do the right thing to protect, you know, those who are vulnerable, to sort of get into a herd mentality, a kind of groupthink empathy. And that all made sense to me. And I never really thought of myself as part of the vulnerable population to where this would be a mortal threat. But for some reason this morning, that framing fell apart. And it was a rough half hour. But I'm okay now. But for the most part, I'm not freaking out about that. I'm not freaking out about too much of anything for some reason. It seems that people with, or maybe I should just say me, with extreme anxiety for most of my life and a really kind of natural propensity to dread, I was sort of ready for this on some level. The neural pathways of this type of thinking that everyone's feeling have been well grooved over the years for me. And there's something almost like a Ritalin effect going on with me. And also doing nothing is something I spent the first decade or two of my career doing, you know, just wandering around or sitting at home thinking and writing things down. I mean, that was the life of the comic. So to answer your question, I'm not freaking out too badly. I'm a little scared in a reasonable way. I might be internalizing a lot of my fear and anxiety.
So I remember we spoke a few years ago about how you were a hypochondriac when you were a kid and your father was a doctor.
Yeah.
But you just described yourself as a recovering hypochondriac. I didn't know you'd been recovering.
Yes, it's taken
That's
me
good.
Years. Well,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and it's really as simple as, you know, training your brain not to go to the worst case scenario immediately and draw that kind of attention to yourself or to put your brain through that. So most of the time, if I experience something symptomatic, I'll be my first thought is like, well, let's give it a few days. You know, not like, oh my God. So I generally do that. And oddly, you know, given the nature of where we're at with the possibilities or the availability for testing on this thing, that's what everyone's sort of, you know, everyone's in that kind of place right now with this particular illness, is that you're going to have to give it a few days because there's nothing else you can do.
These are dark times for hypochondriacs.
That's for sure, Terry. And a lot of people are freaking out. But I can't say because, there's something about freaking out about your health or about immediately thinking the worst thing and about then putting that out into the world or living in that anxiety. There's definitely a selfishness to it. It is a self-centered activity. And, you know, to kind of like get hold of yourself and say like, well, let's see what happens. You know, let me get a night's sleep. Let me wait. You know, if the symptoms aren't, you know, that you have to go to the hospital, you should know what those are. You know, you can usually kind of get through it, not unlike any other sort of anxiety.
Well, I think, you know, one thing for hypochondriacs who are prone to thinking that they have to call a doctor immediately, it's like you're being told now to just kind of calm down unless you really think you're very sick. So I think in a lot of ways people will have to follow your advice.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's where I grew my hypochondria, is that, you know, my father was a doctor, so he was always right there. And if I was really freaking out, he could just refer me to one of his friends and drive me over there to his house. So those days are far behind me.
So some of your End Times Fun special is about being Jewish but not having faith. And you say, but if I'm terrified, I'll go mystical. And sometimes that doesn't make sense. So are you going mystical?
No, I'm not right now. I'm going very practical. And I think it's not about having faith. It's about having God. Maybe I don't remember my special, but, you know, I don't have a functioning God or sense of God. But I do have my Jewish identity. And I tend to, you know, oddly, through a series of rationalizations, I can find my way to faith. And going mystical is really something my brain kind of naturally does. You know, and I think it is the seed of conspiratorial thinking as well, which I had a problem with that before it was popular with wrong-minded people. But there's been plenty of conspiratorial thinking on both sides of this ideological spectrum. But I think that going mystical is your brain kind of really, you know, striving or compulsively or anxiously trying to make sense of something that you can't make sense of through logic or you're ill-informed.
So when you say you have faith in what?
I don't know that things might be okay. It's really being challenged lately, but I think that some of the kind of disposition that I have in the new special is a different disposition to me. Maybe it's because I'm older. Maybe I have some sort of early onset dementia. But a lot of the things that used to really drive me crazy don't. I don't remember a lot of the things I used to. You know, I kind of live day to day. I've always been that way in the last few years. I think it's because I've been terribly busy and overly anxious and in some sort of a stress mode where my body just relaxes. And I really don't know what my schedule is tomorrow. It's a little easier now. We all have the same schedule. What are you doing tomorrow? I guess nothing. But, I do think to answer your question that I've relaxed into something. I don't know if it's, you know, my sense of my own mortality or whatever. And I don't have children, so I'm not sort of, you know, presented with, you know, this kind of like, are things going to be okay for them kind of thing. I know ultimately things will be okay with me. I've done a lot of the things I want to do in my life. And I think that I tried to spread it out, or my brain wants to spread it out among everybody, that things are going to be okay. But clearly we don't know that. But for some reason, my brain is doing that still. And I'm not going to poke at it too hard. I know what the other thing is. I know what the opposite of that is.
So, Mark, I know from your podcast, because in the beginning of your podcast, you always talk about what's happening in your life. So your relationship broke up with your partner, I don't know, about a year ago, maybe?
Yeah. About a year ago. Yes. Mm-hmm. We broke up, and I've since been seeing somebody else. It's difficult, you know, even if breaking up is the right thing to do, it's still difficult.
So are you living alone now or living
with I live alone, and but I've been seeing the director, Lynn Shelton. You know, we're both out of work, so we're definitely spending time together, and she directed my last two specials.
And your movie, Sword of Trust.
That's a fun little movie. Yeah, she directed that, and she's directed me in Glow.
You know, these are times that try relationships. Like you said in your in a recent podcast, you know, you were saying that a lot of people are living alone, feeling isolated, and that's really terrible. But a lot of people are living with families or friends or relatives, and like they're getting on each other's nerves probably. So it's like, it's just a test for everybody.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, just the, you know, without having the ability to just go like, I'm going to run to the store, or I'm going to go do this or that for 5 minutes, a half hour, or just go to work. I mean, it's going to be a real test. People are really going to see what each other is made out of. That's for sure. And I don't know how long it's going to take for people to stop being snarky and cute about quarantine. Yeah, I just don't know when that tone's going to change. I don't know how long this is going to go on for, but I'm just waiting for the shift from like, these are the records I listen to, put to get me out of my house, please. You know.
Are you good at being alone?
I'm okay. You know, I tend to, like, I lose track of time and days. Like, I've lived a life, the job I've chosen is a fairly solitary job, being stand-up, and there have been certainly long periods of my life where I've been solo and doing that. I tend to nap more when I'm alone, but I'm okay alone. There have been times in my life where I've thought, like, you know, this is really the best of all possible worlds, is just to be alone and just see some people occasionally. But I guess as I get older, I'm learning that there's some merit to sort of opening yourself up to being in some sort of relationship. I think that gives life a bit more meaning and comfort. Though, as I said, as we know, it can be difficult.
You do your podcast from home. Mm. And this is the first interview I'm recording at home. And let me explain. Everybody, most of the people on Fresh Air now are working at home. And I now have a microphone at home. I've recorded the intro copy, the introductions and everything for a couple of shows. But this is the first interview I'm doing at home. And I have to tell you, it feels a little bit strange. First of all, I'm just like, there's no reason to get out of my chair. I don't have to go. I don't get up and talk to my producers. Even like the trip to the bathroom, it's like a lot shorter than at the radio station. So yeah. Even like that little bit of exercise is like totally diminished. Give me some advice about working at home. And another thing I have to say about it is that I live in a pretty small home with my husband and our cat. Uh-huh. And I feel like I'm taking up all the space here because I'm transforming our little home into, like, my studio. seriously. So give me some advice.
Well, I got to be honest with you. You sound more comfortable, Terry. You sound looser. You sound grounded. You sound like I think it changes your tone a little bit to be in your living environment, which is nice. I think that's a good thing.
Thank you. What? You made me feel good.
Yeah, good. We'll see
how long that lasts.
Well, you know, the thing about working at home, like it used to be a real separation for me because you still get into the same mindset. You know, like I would, in my old house, I would walk out back to the garage and it was time to work, you know, and it's the same in my new place. You know, I walk out to the garage and I set up, you know, I've got my little cocoon there. I got sound panels up. I got my gear and, you know, and I lock in to do the work. But there is something about being grounded amongst your own things and your own animals and the people in your life, whether they're in the other room or in the house, that I feel like you can feel it all, you know, coming through you and into the mic, and it adds something that I think is grounding and great. But you know, in terms of tricks, I mean, you know what they are. Like, you did it today already. You got to turn your phone off. You got to make sure the levels are good. Maybe you still got somebody doing that somewhere else. You want to make sure you have all your stuff ready to go. It's just basic stuff, and hopefully nobody makes any weird noises. Or with my studio, I got to be careful that people aren't doing yard work next door or whatever. But that's become sort of a texture of my podcast. There's going to be things that come and go. Maybe that's just going to be the future, Terry, where even fresh air, you're going to hear a siren or two or something happen outside of the street, or your cat's going to knock something over, or your husband's going to not know you're on the air. Those are things you're going to have to integrate into the show now, Terry.
No, I think you're right. And I have to say, like, our cat has the loudest and most persistent meow I've ever heard.
Oh, so,
if he gets hungry, it will be heard.
Good. That's a good tease. Now everyone's going to be waiting for that. You're going to have to make it happen now, Terry.
So, I'm thinking you interviewed President Obama.
Yeah.
In your garage when you were still doing your podcast from the garage.
I do it from the garage still. It's a garage studio still. I had
but
to make it.
It's a different garage. Right?
Different garage, a little fancier.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you imagine interviewing President Trump in your garage?
Yeah, I mean, I could. I mean, I doubt that it'll happen, but the agreement I've had with Brendan McDonald, my producer, is that if he wants to, like, we don't really interview politicians, but we'll interview presidents. So if he's willing to do it on the same terms that Obama did, which is, the questions weren't vetted, and we get final cut, that we have to be willing to do that.
So what are you doing?
I don't know what that would be like. That would be crazy.
It would be interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to your garage, though.
I don't think so. And the weird thing is like, having, grown up with a fairly narcissistic man as a father, I kind of know what's inside there.
What comparisons do you see between your father and the president?
Well, not many, other than the sort of basic narcissism. I think that Trump is clearly a really rare case of really, truly pathological narcissism. I don't think there is a huge amount of those. I think there are narcissistic people. But I think that my father was a bit, the complete inability to sort of place themselves, to take any real responsibility for things or to have a certain amount of real empathy, and to a kind of inability to kind of listen, some of those things. My dad's not, and also the anger thing or the defensiveness thing, there's a little of that, but he's not as malignant as Trump is. But I do know, I kind of have a sense of what's inside there, and it's not pretty. And they have everything invested in protecting themselves from any self-awareness. So if you can get in there to where that self-awareness could possibly be, or open up a small portal to it, there's just a sort of lifetime worth of vulnerability and anger in there that is completely chaotic and unmanageable and kind of scary. So they put to, now they have this this fairly weird shell that they've built for themselves, but the undefined kind of gooey center of a narcissist is a really a scary emotional place.
So since a lot of people are looking for ways to spend time at home, what have you been doing? Have you been reading or listening to music or watching TV?
Listening to a lot of music. Uh-huh. I've been listening to a lot of music, and I've been cooking a lot, and like I've stockpiled a lot of food, and just trying to stay on top of eating healthy. And we figured out how to freeze greens and vegetables. We made some stock, soup stock, and just trying to make sure I have enough food. Somehow or another, I lucked out, and I think I've got enough toilet paper to last for a while. But I've been I've been going through the Tom Petty live anthology on vinyl. That's been nice. There's a Light in the Attic vinyl of Native North American folk and rock music anthology that I've been listening to. So I've been doing some, you know, serious listening sessions. I've been reading a bit, but I got the Criterion Channel, watching old movies I've never seen before, and like that, you know.
Mark, it's been so great to talk with you. It's great to hear your voice. It's great to hear you're well. Thank you so much for coming to our show. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, I loved it. I love you. I love talking to you. I'm glad you're well. I just have so much respect for you, and I'm always honored to be on the show. Thanks, Terry.
Mark Maron's new comedy special, End Times Fun, is streaming on Netflix. You've probably heard our guest, actor Hank Azaria, more times than you realize. He's voiced dozens of characters for The Simpsons, including Mo the Bartender, Chief Wiggum, and Dr. Nick. One character he no longer performs is Apu, which he'll explain a little later. He's appeared as an actor in many films, including The Birdcage, Shattered Glass, Dodgeball, Night at the Museum, and Tuesdays with Maury, and in several TV series. He's currently starring in the TV series Brockmire on IFC. It's a dark comedy in which Azaria plays a talented baseball announcer with a drinking problem whose life takes some strange and surprising turns. Azaria is also an executive producer of the show. Hank Azaria spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Hank Azaria, welcome to Fresh Air. It's good to have you back. Let's start with a clip, the scene that kicked off this series, Brockmire, and I'll just kind of set it up for the audience. I mean, you're a successful big league baseball announcer, and you always end your broadcasts by referring to your beloved wife, Lucy, saying, "Lucy, get supper on the stove because this ball game is over." And in this particular scene, you're calling a game, and we see that you're drinking bourbon heavily. And while you're calling the game, you tell a story about what had happened that day.
As baseball announcers do.
Right. They always do that. This one ends up being a pretty memorable story. Two things I want to say quickly about the scene we're going to hear. First, it's at a ball game, and the audio that you'll hear changes a bit because at times we're hearing you in the booth, and we hear what the fans at the stadium are hearing over the PA announcer, and then other times it's what is going through the broadcast. But it's the same scene, just the audio is a little different.
You hear live and then in the ballpark, then what folks at home hear. Yeah.
Exactly. The other thing, I'll just note that this scene has been edited just a bit to make it suitable for radio. What happens is you're broadcasting the game, and you tell the audience that today is the anniversary of the day that you first told your wife, Lucy, you loved her.
I had some time at the ballpark this afternoon to reflect upon this wonderful anniversary as Ivania slashes one fan to the right side. And I decided to go on home and surprise my wife, Lucy, with some gardenias. They're her favorite flower. Please imagine my surprise when I opened my front door to find about a half dozen naked folks sprawled out in my living room, engaged in what can only be described as a desperate and a hungry kind of a lovemaking. And right in the center of it all was my wife. My wife, Lucy. She was wearing a and she was our neighbor, Bob Greenwald. That'll bring Clark up to bat. Clark having himself a heck of an afternoon with two doubles. Bob Greenwald, that two-faced SOB. I hosted his kid's bar mitzvah.
Here's the kicker. Here's what kills me. My wife, Lucy, has the stone. She has the unmitigated gall to turn to me and tell me that she is a sexual astronaut. I mean, what is that? What does that even mean?
Oh, boy. And that's our guest, Hank Azaria, in the opening scene of his series, Brockmire, on IFC. This scene, it gets pretty raw, and, of course, he's interrupted, and that's followed by a meltdown at Brockmire's news conference. It detonates his career. You want to just pick it up from there and tell us how that gets us into the series?
We started the series in 2017, so this was going back to 2007 when what you just heard happened. At a press conference, he's supposed to apologize, but he's pretty much having a nervous breakdown, and he strips off his shirt, and, baseball throws him out, and he just loses him. He just gets lost for about a decade, 10 years, goes off into the world, drinking and drugging and sexing. You know, he had been completely faithful and in love with his wife, which is, you know, what really, and just had a vision of her as this pure being. It turns out she's this tremendously active sex addict and had been having all kinds of crazy sex behind his back their whole marriage. And he kind of turns into a crazy libertine in response, an alcoholic, and goes off, calling cockfights in Manila is where he ends up, but he called like a Lithuanian wife-carrying competition, which is a real thing, by the way. And then misses baseball, gets a call from a very small-time, bottom-of-the-barrel minor league baseball team owner, played by Amanda Peet, named Julia James, who wants him to come in and call baseball games for them back in Morristown, Pennsylvania, which is a fracking town. And the name of the team is the Morristown Frackers, and that's probably the classiest thing about the team. And that's where season one begins, really, is his journey trying to make it back to the big leagues, starting at the very bottom of the barrel.
Right, and a lot of fun ensues. You know, this voice, this baseball broadcaster's voice, did you model that on any particular voice you grew up hearing?
I'll answer you in the voice, Dave, if I may. I call this the generic baseball announcer voice of the 1970s. And much to my surprise, so does Bob Costas. Unprompted, he said the same thing to me. Bob appears in the series in season three, I believe. And he said, this is the generic baseball announcer voice of the 1970s. And I said, Bob, that's exactly right. That's what I call it. And you don't hear this voice too much anymore. You hear it a lot. Calling, when we still had NCAA basketball, which I'm sure we'll have again soon, folks. Keep the faith. you hear this a lot on Saturday afternoons, Temple versus Duke. You hear this guy calling it. And it also was the voice in the 70s and 80s of a lot of pitchmen, announcers on television. The Ginsu knife. In Japan, the hand is a lethal weapon. But this does not work with a tomato. And I got fascinated with this as a kid. Like, why is this the generic voice of announcers? And I started to wonder, do they always talk like this, even their private lives? So they come home and say, hi, honey, what is for dinner? My goodness, I am looking forward to a spirited lovemaking session later. And you can see how that led to sort of some of the comic premises for Brockmeyer.
So much of his life is deeply involved with alcohol and drugs to some extent. From the bios I've read of you, I don't know if you've had any issues with that. But I'm wondering what you drew on to kind of, capture that part of the story.
Yeah, listen, I've been sober 13 years, and I've been in the recovery community for even longer. I first went into the Al-Anon program 20 years ago, which is for like the families and loved ones of alcoholics. So I have a long history of dealing with of drugs and alcoholism in others and in myself. Yet ironically, I did not mean for this series to go there. That was, again, all Joel Church Cooper kind of seeing in this. I think I had unconsciously created quite an alcoholic character, but I didn't realize it. Huh. And it was Joel who wanted to kind of follow through on that journey. And I was like, are you sure we want to do all this? I was like, well, as long as it's funny, I'm okay with it. That was really my only rule. So, yeah, I drew on that a lot. And in season two, when Brockmeyer gets sober and hits a bottom and has an intervention, Joel asked me a lot about what that experience was like for me. I never had an intervention done on me, nor did I attend rehab, but I've done it with other people, and I do know a lot about that. So he picked my brain a lot about what early sobriety is like and what hitting a bottom is like emotionally and what the issues really are. And things like, how does somebody possibly reconcile the idea of a higher power if they totally don't believe in that, but they're required to go through that for their sobriety? But that's really the only time Joel leaned on me for my experience in writing this series.
Well, you've been doing voices on The Simpsons for more than 30 years now, right?
I believe 32 to be exact, uh-huh. Yeah.
You grew up in Queens, New York, and I read that your mom spoke Ladino, this ancient form of Spanish that's written in Hebrew, right?
My mom and dad.
Ah.
Yeah.
And I wonder if hearing all those sounds at home and all the accents in New York is one of the things that gave you a better ear and made you a better mimic?
I mean, I guess. I mean, a lot of people, grew up with that. I think you're
true.
Either, how some people can curl their tongue and some people can't, or some people can like the taste of cilantro and to others it tastes like soap. I think being a mimic is kind of like that. You either can physically do it, sort of, or you can't. And I found that, as a very young person I found I could, and I thought it was like I cracked myself up with it. I thought it was really fun to be able to sound like other people. And so I kept doing it. And then, obviously, and then, you know, got lucky and got my job at The Simpsons when I was about 22 or 23 years old. And so that sort of kept the muscle active, as it were. I mean, every week I had to do 5, 10, 15 different voices. And, you know, eventually you'd get the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours where you're pretty practiced right. at doing something.
Well, let's hear a clip from The Simpsons. This is Mo the bartender. I mean, one of your best known, I guess. And in this scene, he's being given a polygraph exam by the police because I guess he's suspected in the shooting of Mr. Burns. And we'll hear the scene. And when he tells the truth, the machine gives it a cheerful ding. When he lies, it buzzes. Let's listen.
Did you hold a grudge against Montgomery Burns?
No. All right, maybe I did, but I didn't shoot him.
Checks out. Okay, sir, you're free to go.
Good, because I got a hot date tonight. A date. Dinner with Fred. Dinner alone. Watching TV alone. All right. I'm going to sit at home and ogle the ladies in the Victoria's Secret catalog. Sears catalog. Now, would you unhook this already, please? I don't deserve this kind of shabby treatment.
Mo the bartender, one of the many voices by our guest, Hank Azaria. Where did Mo's voice come from?
It's funny, listening to that was from a long time ago. Mo's voice is a little deeper now. He's sort of deepened over the years. Mo, he talked like the, Al Pacino, young Al Pacino.
Uh-huh.
You know, Dog Day Afternoon and Godfather Al Pacino, kind of yeah. talked like this. And I sort of was enamored of that voice. And when I auditioned for The Simpsons, Dave, I was doing a play in Los Angeles at a small, you know, theater, and was doing a voice of a drug dealer and kind of doing a Pacino like this, and I auditioned to play Mo like this, and then they said they wanted it to be gravelly. So if you take that young Pacino voice and make it gravelly, I don't know, this is what came out, and this is what they hired.
So you want to give us one other favorite in how you got the voice? I mean, are there 20 different characters you've done? I mean,
there's a lot. There are more. I mean, yeah, technically, yeah. like over
right,
200.
Because some of them are quick in and outs, but yeah.
I probably do 30 to 40 running characters that appear in the show at any given time. One of my favorites is Comic Book Guy. He is based on a fellow that lived next door to me freshman year of college. He talked like this. Snake, the sort of convict dude, is kind of a combination between Jeff Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High and another dude I went to college with.
Wow. You know, you were always a great mimic, and you started doing these characters when you were like 22. And I mean, I assume that as you've done a lot more roles and a lot of dramatic roles over time, and I assume that your acting skills have grown. Did that change the way you did the characters at all?
Yes. That brilliant acting teacher named Roy London, who passed away, boy, gosh, 25 years now? I got into his class probably after being on The Simpsons about 3 or 4 years. And I was in that class for about 3 or 4 years. And that, I think, really, more than anything else, that was sort of my finishing school or graduate program or whatever, if you will, and master class. He got me through a lot of blocks that I had as an actor that I didn't know I had. And I think after that, not that the voices changed or the jokes changed, but I think my approach and realizing that I could fill those characters in emotionally and truthfully deepened a bit. And I think made my Simpsons work better. You know, as I said, I'm a mimic. And so I sort of approached acting and my desire to be an actor as I kind of want to be somebody else, you know. And a lot of this touches on some sobriety issues and low self-esteem issues and, you know, feeling like you're not good enough or you're not enough. And so I wanted to be an actor to sort of escape who I was because some of that was painful for me, which is also why I drank. And what I discovered in acting class, much to my chagrin, Dave, was that that's all fine. But to be a really good actor, let alone a great actor, you actually have to be yourself. You have to be willing to emotionally reveal yourself to people, you know, on stage or in front of a camera, which I did not like at all. I'm like, that's exactly the opposite of why I wanted to do this. And Roy kind of really took me through almost in like a therapy way sometimes of how to sort of be willing to share myself, and that I came to trust that my honest reactions to things were not only preferable and not to be hidden, but to be shared, and were the way to, what else did I have to really use as an actor except my own real experience and how I really felt about things? And once I was able to bring that to the voices, like, so whether I'm talking like Chief Wiggum or I'm talking like Moe, or I'm talking that comic book guy, I feel like underneath it all, it's okay for Hank to really share what he thinks and feels. And I think that made things more believable and funnier. And for Brockmeyer, too.
You know, on The Simpsons, you're no longer doing the voice of Apu, the American Indian guy who owned the Quickie Mart. And this followed a protest campaign of sorts. There were questions raised about the fact that, you know, that you as a white actor were portraying this Indian stereotype at a time when there weren't a lot of well-known Indian characters in American culture. And the comedian Hari Kondabolu raised this issue and then made a documentary about it. You want to just share your thinking about how, share with us how your thinking has evolved on this?
Yeah, sure. I had been doing that voice for about 25, 27 years before I really heard anybody express upset with it. And one of the first things that happened was that comedian Hari Kondabolu actually tweeted at me a link to a performance he did on a late night comedy show where he did a routine about how much he resented the voice of Apu and the character of Apu, or things about it anyway. And he said it sounded like, the voice sounded like a white guy doing an impression of another white guy who was making fun of his father. And you know, that was really kind of the first I'd heard of that kind of upset and bristling over the role. And then not long after that, I got reached out to by a reporter, a writer named Malika Rao, who was doing an article for the Huffington Post. And we sort of, I talked to her about it, and we did a little bit of a deeper dive in it. That's what really started me thinking, because with Hari, it sort of felt like comedian to comedian. And my first reaction, and not so much, you know, person to person or not that I wasn't taking it seriously, but I kind of got pretty defensive and bristled. And I looked at it from much more of a comedy perspective, like, you know, we make fun of everybody at The Simpsons. And you know, where does this kind of thing end if you're going to, you know, have me not do the voice of this character? And I got pretty defensive about it. And then over time, as I realized the criticism wasn't just Hari or a comedy routine, but was really shared by many people in the Indian community in this country, in South Asian community, I started taking a look at it. And what I realized was over time, after a lot of soul searching and doing workshops and reading and talking to people, was that I had a blind spot or two when it came to this character. I think as evidenced, the best way I can express it is, I based the voice of Apu, I was imitating a lot of convenience store clerks that I heard, but it was also based on a Peter Sellers voice. Peter Sellers did a movie called The Party, I think it was in 1966, where he played an Indian actor. And he's doing a pretty thick Indian accent in brown face. Now, to me, you know, there I am. I saw this movie when I'm a teenager, okay? I'm an aspiring mimic and comedic voice actor. And to me, there was, and I worshipped Peter Sellers. I thought he was a genius and hilarious. And to me, I didn't distinguish between his, you know, silly French detective Clouseau accent from the Pink Panther movies or his weird German Dr. Strangelove accent in Dr. Strangelove. So, I mean, that's a blind spot. That's in the great show business tradition of we make fun of everybody and everybody's fair game, and that's fair enough. But the character had unintended consequences for people, kids growing up in this country, Indian and South Asian kids growing up in this country had to live with that character and be called Apu in ways they didn't appreciate. And that was a lot of my journey with that character. It took some years to figure it out for me.
I want to talk about another role of yours. This was The Birdcage in 1996, back quite a while ago, but it was a big role for you, I think. And I thought we'd hear a clip. This is the film. It's based on the French film, La Cage aux Folles. And you play the housekeeper of a middle-aged gay couple played by Robin Williams and Nathan Lane, who live above a nightclub that features drag queens. The Robin character owns the place Nathan Lane performs in it. Your character, named Agador Spartacus, is Guatemalan and gay and aspires to perform in the club. And this is a short scene where Robin Williams' character has gotten up in the morning and you give him a strong cup of coffee and then you ask why he hasn't let you perform in the club. Let's listen.
Good morning.
Not yet.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Oh, what is this, sludge?
Yes, it's sludge. I thought I'd make a nice change from coffee. So why don't you tell me you think bad last night, you bad man? I would not have been so sassy to you.
You put some clothes on.
Armand, why don't you let me be in the show? Come on, aren't you afraid of my watermelon-ness?
Your what?
My watermelon-ness, my natural heat. You're afraid I'm too primitive, right, to be on the stage with your little estrogen rockets, right?
Oh, yes, you're right. I'm afraid of your heat.
Robin Williams. And yes, that was our guest Hank Azaria as Agador Spartacus in the film The Birdcage. Boy, that's a long way from your voice, but I guess this is what you do. Tell us about getting the voice of Agador.
Guatemalan. So I worked at the time with a wonderful voice coach, accent coach named Robert Easton, who's no longer with us. And so we, you know, studied Guatemalan, and then I started. I had sort of two versions of the character, the voice that you heard there, who actually now when I do it, it's a little higher, but it's sort of this guy. And a little more kind of a little tougher, a little lower, or something like this. And I sort of tried them out for a friend of mine who happens to be this amazing drag performer. and he sort of helped me pick the voice you heard. And then I realized actually into rehearsal that, you know what, Dave, I was really just imitating my maternal grandmother.
Wow.
That's like as you mentioned, I grew up in a Sephardic Jewish household, which speaks Ladino, which is a Spanish dialect. And that was very much the accent and way my grandmother sounded. And she was a very loving maternal person, and which felt right for the character as well. So I sort of was doing an impression of my grandma.
Right. You know, it's so interesting as I listen to that. And we talked about the controversy about the Apu voice on The Simpsons. And, I mean, this film was, what, 24 years ago. And I wonder if it were made today, if, a white guy doing a Guatemalan voice like this would draw criticism. Has this occurred to you?
Absolutely, it's occurred. This is a good show, Dave. You're very insightful. It absolutely has occurred to me. And I think we can say that pretty much for sure if this movie were being made today, they wouldn't offer me this role. They would get a gay Guatemalan or Latin guy to play it, and which I think is as it should be and is right. I did my best with this role. I did it with a lot of love and pride and as meticulously as I could. I don't regret doing it. But I acknowledge that it would be done differently today.
I want to ask, too, before we leave The Birdcage, this is a hilarious film, and Robin Williams just is so – he's such an improviser. And I'm just wondering, were you breaking up all the time on the set? Were there scenes that were improvised?
Yes. Robin is his shtick was to go wildly off script and with flights of fancy, and it was often hilarious. But in this particular movie, directed by the late, great Mike Nichols, God, all these people are gone. It's really sad. But Mike didn't want that. He wanted to play as a really tight farce. You know, he wanted to keep the pace moving. And so we rehearsed it like a play, which is very unusual for a movie. For about 2 or 3 weeks, we gathered over at Paramount and just ran the scenes and rehearsed it as if it was a play. And we were pretty much all off book and ready to go with each scene, because he didn't want to do too much coverage. He wanted to just have the scenes play in real time. And if you look back at that movie, there isn't too much close-ups, or it just kind of plays. And he said to Robin, and to Nathan Lane, who was very witty, tremendous improviser himself. He said, "Guy, Mike talked like this." He said, "Now, gentlemen, I know you love to go off script, and it's delightful. So what we're going to do is we're going to rehearse, and feel free to say whatever you like and go as crazy off book as you like. And Elaine May wrote it, is going to take it all down. And we're going to choose the lines we like the best, and we're going to stick with those. We're not going to improvise on the day." And that drove Robin insane, as you might imagine. And that's what we did. And Robin would beg for what he called wild takes. He called Mike boss. "Boss, boss, please, wild take. Boss, please, wild take." And so we'd do a take where Robin could go insane. As insane as he liked. And some of that made it into the movie, but most of it was pretty much as we rehearsed it.
Well, Hank Azaria, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Hank Azaria spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Azaria stars in the IFC series Brockmire.